Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Inflation, rising interest rates, volatility. Whatever markets have in store, a financial advisor can help. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Mars, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 22nd of September, these are our main stories. Anti-government protests are held in the Armenian capital over Azerbaijan's defeat of ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh. A military judge at Guantanamo Bay has ruled that a Yemeni man charged over the 9/11 attacks is mentally unfit to stand trial. The Indian Parliament passes a bill that will reserve a third of seats in Parliament and state assemblies for women. Also in this podcast, a stash of the opioid fentanyl is found in the New York nursery where a toddler has died of a suspected drug overdose. And 7 years after blasting off, a rocket prepares to deliver what scientists hope will be the secrets of how life began on Earth.
We're addressing profound questions that at some point in our lives, everybody asks ourselves. Where did we come from? And more importantly, are we alone in the universe?
Many of the world's most entrenched conflicts come down to issues of identity and self-determination. The crisis in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh is one such conflict. It lies within Azerbaijan, but for decades, ethnic Armenians who live there have been trying to create their own independent state. It's led to countless acts of violence in which thousands have died. There's been more fighting this week, with Azerbaijan forces pushing back separatist militants. Speaking at the United Nations Security Council, the Armenian Foreign Minister, Ararat Mirzoyan, accused Azerbaijan of unlawful actions.
Well, each of us comes here to contribute to peace in our region, in South Caucasus. On 19th of September, Azerbaijan unleashed yet another large-scale offensive against the people of Nagorno-Karabakh, in blatant violation of the international law.
The Armenian foreign minister accused his neighbour of wanting to finalise the ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh's Armenian population. Meanwhile, in the Azerbaijani capital, Baku, Hikmet Hajiyev, foreign policy advisor to the president, said Azerbaijan wanted to reintegrate the region peacefully.
There will be difficulties and there could be certain challenges as well. Nobody denies that. An important thing is that we have a political will to go forward with an reintegration. And while talking about reintegration, we are talking about a peaceful reintegration model of Karabakh Armenians to the political, economic, social spectrum of Azerbaijan.
Siranush Sargsyan is an ethnic Armenian in Stepanakert, the de facto capital of Nagorno-Karabakh. She says no one believes the talks at the UN or elsewhere will work.
Here, it doesn't matter you in one of village or in Stepanakert, there is no safety, and these negotiations, talks, nobody actually believe it. Nobody believe like somehow it is possible without international guarantees, like we can stay here. So, and if there is not provided, most of people, yes, they want to leave.
Our Caucasus correspondent, Rehan Dimitri, tell me more about the situation there.
Reports from Stepanakert is that there are thousands of displaced people. These are the people who had to leave their homes from the villages that are close to the front line. A lot of people spent the night in schools or in churches, in kind of temporary places. And I guess the biggest question for them is they don't really know what's coming next. And as we just heard from Siranush, this journalist in Stepanakert, a lot of people would want to leave Nagorno-Karabakh, but no such option is being given to them just yet. You also quoted the Armenian foreign minister at the UN Security Council, and he accused Azerbaijan of wanting to carry out an ethnic cleansing and said that there were facts of mass crimes. And he said that the images from Nagorno-Karabakh are really, really shocking. There are homeless women, children, and mothers, a lot of people who are searching for their children. And they all think that, you know, because every single family in Nagorno-Karabakh would have a family member who fought in many wars with Azerbaijan, and they're worried that they would be arrested. But this morning we heard from Azerbaijani presidential special advisor Hikmat Hajiyev, who said that Azerbaijan is envisaging an amnesty for Karabakh Armenian fighters, for those who give up their arms. Although Azerbaijan says there are some individual groups and officers who have refused to lay down their arms so far, and they don't want to accept Azerbaijani terms of conditions. So there's a risk of insurgency.
So briefly, Rehan, this has all come about because the Armenians within Nagorno-Karabakh are on that back foot militarily. Meanwhile, in the Armenian capital, a lot of protesters out on the streets protesting about what's going on, probably putting pressure on the Armenian authorities to do something about it.
There were big protests on Tuesday and Wednesday when Azerbaijan began what it describes as its anti-terror operation, much less so yesterday. But of course, there is pressure on the Armenian prime minister to resign over the handling of this situation.
Since 2002, almost 800 people have been detained at one time or another at the American base at Guantanamo Bay on the island of Cuba. Of those, 11 have been charged with war crimes in the military commission system. 10 are awaiting trial and one has been convicted. Now, a Yemeni man accused of involvement with the September the 11th attacks in New York City 22 years ago has been ruled unfit to stand trial. I found out more details from our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
Well, this is Ramzi bin al-Shaib, who is one of the better known suspects held at Guantanamo Bay linked directly to the September the 11th, 2001 attacks. He was accused, or he is accused, of being an organiser of the Hamburg cell, which was one of the place where one of the groups of hijackers came from, which carried out the attack in the United States, and having wanted to actually be part of the attack himself, and a link back to Al-Qaeda, which organised the attacks out of Afghanistan. So he was considered a significant player, that's the allegation, in those attacks. And this was going to be one of the most high profile of these military commissions that have been due to take place at Guantanamo. He was going to stand trial along with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's often considered the kind of mastermind of those attacks. But his lawyers had been arguing that he was mentally unfit to stand trial for the death penalty specifically, which is what he was at risk of being given as a sentence. Now, the argument was specifically that it was he was mentally unfit because he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and delusion because of the way he'd been treated in custody. Specifically, after he'd been arrested, he spent time in what were called black sites, which were secret places where the CIA carried out torture on suspects. And he was one of those held in those before being transferred to Guantanamo Bay openly. So the accusation was that that has left him mentally unfit. And that's always been one of the challenges for these military commissions, is that those defending the suspects have been saying that evidence was tainted, or in this case, someone was made mentally unfit by what had happened to them in custody. And in this case, yesterday, the judge at Guantanamo agreed with those defence lawyers.
And Gordon, briefly, do we know what the status of the other 10 people awaiting trial is, whether or not they will argue similar things?
Well, I think we're expecting this. They are not quite arguing the same thing in terms of being mentally unfit, but the legal battles have been going on for so long over these military commissions that there's been delay after delay, and it is really unclear how long this process will really take.
Gordon Carrera. After six attempts, a bill has been passed in India which is set to reserve a third of the seats in the lower house of parliament and in state assemblies for women. The bill was first introduced almost three decades ago. It often failed because of strong disapproval from the country's overwhelmingly male lawmakers. Our South Asia correspondent, Samira Hussain, told us more about it.
If you look at the way women have played a very significant role in politics, they've had female prime ministers. Currently, there's a female president of India. And if you look at the way polls have worked, there's as much trust in female politicians as there are in male politicians. But if you look at the representation within parliament, you're seeing that representation has only come up since in the 80s. From 9%, it's gone up to about 15%. So what this bill is aiming to do was to try and get more political participation from women by reserving 33% of all seats for women. Now, this is going to last, once it's implemented, it's going to last for about 15 years, and then it can be reinstated. Women represent a massive voting bloc in this country. And if you don't have enough women representing in parliament, then do you really have an effective government that really reflects the population? So they're really trying to encourage more women representation. I think what's interesting is the political aspect to this, is that it's actually not going to be implemented until about 2029. So the opposition party is quite critical of the fact that the ruling government has said, okay, let's enact this bill and let's push it through after 30 years. And they're saying that, look, this is really an election ploy. Since there's going to be elections next year in India, this allows the ruling BJP party to say, look at what we're doing. We're trying to get more women into parliament. But because it's not going to go into effect until 2029, it doesn't really benefit any other political parties. What the Indian government is really trying to signal is that there should be more participation by women, that women should be more encouraged to come and join and represent in politics.
Samira Hussain. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has arrived in Canada. He was met on the runway in Ottawa by the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. It comes a day after his meeting with Joe Biden at the White House, as he seeks to rally support for his troops' ongoing offensive against Russia. Well, speaking in Washington, Mr. Zelensky said Ukraine was looking for more funding and insisted the war was vitally important for the West.
If we fall, half of Europe would again be in danger of being in Moscow's sphere of influence. But American investment in Ukrainian security and global protection of freedom is working 100%, every cent.
Well, I asked the BBC's James Waterhouse in Kyiv what's in store for Mr. Zelensky from the Canadians.
You'll expect a continuation of this warm reception. Canada is another loyal ally of Ukraine. It is a military supporter. There is a sizable Ukrainian community in Canada who are provided with state support. But I think the real prize of this diplomatic journey of President Zelensky is behind him in the US, with, you know, which spearheads the Western allies' effort in supporting Ukraine. I think what we're seeing from President Zelensky this time around, yes, we are seeing some pomp and ceremony. We are seeing some warm handshakes and embraces, not least with Joe Biden yesterday in the Oval Office. But I think there is now hard negotiations to be done for President Zelensky, because we are starting to see a direct correlation between the pace and scale of Ukraine's counteroffensive and the increased scepticism, shall we say, in political circles. There have been discreet meetings with some Republican politicians yesterday where there are some hard-aligned views that questioning why Ukraine should continue to be presented with, in their words, blank checks, and they're questioning what a Ukrainian victory could look like. And when Kyiv has always said, look, we will not be rushed in our military efforts, where they lost a lot of men and equipment early on in their counteroffensive, this will be a real test of that, and this is why we are seeing President Zelensky continue to try and reach those who are starting to become increasingly sceptical.
And James, over the last couple of days, we've seen mixed reports coming out of Poland as to whether or not they're going to carry on sending military aid to Ukraine. How much concern is there in Kyiv right now?
I think on the issue of Poland, I think if we look at the language being used, concerns have been eased slightly. The Polish are saying the words were taken out of, slightly misinterpreted. They're not currently producing weapons for Ukraine, but they were dangling some question marks over future supplies, all in an argument over Ukrainian grain, which has flooded Polish markets, and subsequent bans have been brought in. It's turned very messy, but I think what it is translating to is a very difficult diplomatic period for President Zelensky, who will be desperate to turn this into something more tangible.
James Waterhouse. Metal mining has always been blamed for polluting the world's rivers and floodplains. And new research has revealed just how much contamination it causes. The global study by British scientists estimates that tens of millions of people have been affected by potentially dangerous concentrations of toxic waste. Our science and climate correspondent, Victoria Gill, has been taking a closer look at their findings.
Waste metals from mines can be bound up in sediment that gets washed down river channels and spread across floodplains. These researchers mapped the location and type of every active and abandoned metal mine in the world and studied how the waste moved and accumulated in the environment. This allowed them to estimate the total area of the earth that's polluted by mine waste. Combining that with population data revealed that 23 million people around the world live on land that's officially contaminated, with levels above an internationally recognised safe threshold. Whether those people are affected by that pollution is impossible to say from this study, but crops grown or livestock grazed on contaminated land can absorb that pollution. And as the demand surges for many metals, like copper and lithium used in electrification and battery technology, the researchers say that future mining needs to be planned carefully to avoid adding to this toxic legacy.
Victoria Gill. Still to come on the Global News Podcast. Brazil's Supreme Court debates whether to decriminalise abortion up to 12 weeks.
I think I speak for everyone when I say that it was a nightmare, she says. We aren't the owners of our bodies, are we? It was something that could have been so simple, but they kept prolonging the suffering.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Money laundering operations.
A cyber criminal group.
These are smart guys.
Seasons 1 and 2 of The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service are available in full right now.
Following the twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service. Catch up with the whole series now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A huge supply of the synthetic drug fentanyl has been found in a children's daycare centre in New York after the death of a child. Our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley, has this report.
Police in New York say they found over a dozen bags containing brown and white powder, and it was secreted under a trapdoor in a nap room, a sleeping room, where young children were sleeping. The owner and the tenant have been charged with narcotics and obstruction charges, but they have essentially said that they believe, as a result of running a drug operation from essentially what is a nursery, they're responsible for poisoning four babies and killing one of them. The legitimate use for fentanyl is for cancer patients and for those recovering from surgery. It's incredibly potent. People will be familiar with morphine. It's a synthetic opioid, but unlike morphine, the same quantities are between 50 and 100 times more potent. Politicians from each side of the political divide say that it's reached pandemic levels. And I'll give you a little bit of an idea of scale on that one. Back in around 2010, around 10% of drugs deaths in the United States were as a result of overdosing on fentanyl. That's raised to around two-thirds today, possibly because it is so much cheaper than other drugs and cheaper than heroin, for instance. And, you know, it would have a similar effect to those who use it. Originally, fentanyl comes from China in its raw form. It then makes its way across into Mexico. And this is why it becomes such a politically hot topic, because Mexico is where this raw material is processed and becomes the fentanyl that's distributed across the United States and the product that's killing so many Americans.
Sean Dilley. Brazil's Supreme Court has started voting on whether to decriminalise abortion. However, the session was quickly postponed after a minister called for the vote to take place in person instead of via video, and no new date has yet been set. Currently, abortion is only allowed in three cases: that of rape, risked to the woman's life, and when the fetus has an undeveloped brain. If the Supreme Court votes in favour, abortion would be decriminalised up to 12 weeks gestation. Our South America correspondent, Katie Watson, reports from Sao Paulo.
Yes, we could, Mexican women chanted, echoing President Obama's favourite phrase. This was the moment the country's Supreme Court decriminalised abortion earlier this month. Dressed in green T-shirts, waving green bandanas, the decision is the latest milestone for the Green Wave movement, regional activists that have worked tirelessly to liberalise strict abortion laws across Latin America. In this week, attention's turned to Brazil. Supreme Court Judge Rosa Weber is about to retire, but before she does, she decided to add a vote on decriminalising abortion in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. For Paloma, the vote couldn't come soon enough. 3 weeks ago, she had an abortion. The baby she was expecting had a rare condition that meant it wouldn't survive birth and could have risked her life too. Therein began a painful process to access a right she thought would be a given. I asked the doctor if my baby would survive, she tells me. He told me I had to wait for it to be born. The nurse who was with him said the baby's heart was beating, that I'd regret the decision in the future. Through tears, Paloma told him the choice was hers. Only it wasn't. There are only three cases in which abortion is allowed in Brazil. Rape, when the woman's life is at risk, or in the case of anencephaly, when the fetus's brain is undeveloped. Paloma's case wasn't one of those. She was told, though, that with two supporting doctors, a judge could likely grant a termination. Her doctor refused, and it took 6 weeks to be granted one, jumping through hurdles all the while. I think I speak for everyone when I say that it was a nightmare, she says. We aren't the owners of our bodies, are we? It was something that could have been so simple, but they kept prolonging the suffering. For Natalia, though, there's never an excuse to end a pregnancy. At 21, she nearly had an abortion until her religious mother convinced her otherwise. 10 years on, now she actively campaigns against liberalising abortion laws. She says that a decision by the Supreme Court would be purely political.
We all know that President Lula has a leftist agenda, an abortionist agenda. Feminists defend freedom to abort, which comes from their sexual liberation. The issues of abortion and feminism work together and they're linked to the left.
But across Brazil and the region, these voices of conservatism are being drowned out by doctors' calls to treat this as a public health issue. It's estimated that by the time a woman is 40, 1 in 7 Brazilians have had at least one abortion. Their argument is that women will seek abortions regardless and they need to be kept safe. Dr. Roberta Cronenberger Santos works in the women's hospital in Santo André, near São Paulo. She's had cases of desperate women who've tried to carry out abortions at home. By the time they come into hospital, they're bleeding and have infections.
We have to understand that it's not a political decision. It's about choices, and we all have a right to choose. The more we talk about it, the more people we will understand. We have never talked so much about women's rights as we are now, talking about this prejudice. All those discussions have come together.
Brazilians are watching the Supreme Court carefully. After discussing the issue for decades, on both sides, few can believe this vote is actually happening.
Katie Watson. In our earlier podcast, we brought you news that the Australian media mogul Rupert Murdoch is stepping down from the helm of his businesses after many decades. His eldest son, Lachlan, is taking over as chairman of both his newspaper and TV empires, News Corp and Fox. 12 years ago in Britain, Rupert Murdoch was forced to close down his newspaper, The News of the World, after its journalists were found to have hacked the phones of countless celebrities and the voicemail of a murdered schoolgirl. His papers have also been accused of distorting the news to ensure his political allies won elections. So, how will the editorial direction of the media empire change under Lachlan Murdoch? A question my colleague Celia Hatton put to Stephen Mayne, who's a former journalist at the Murdoch tabloids in Australia and who now describes himself as a shareholder activist.
Well, I think Lachlan is a bit of a chip off the old block, certainly in terms of the politics. So you won't see any change in terms of MAGA, republicanism, Fox News, climate denialism, those sorts of things. So Rupert wants to hand over to someone like him. Lachlan is the only adult child standing, if you like, who is prepared to continue on what Rupert has done. But there's only one Rupert Murdoch. So really, at one level, it's quite unfair to think that one of his kids can sit there and become the chairman of two enormous global media empires and run it from Sydney, where he's moved back to a couple of years ago. So I think it's a bit of a poison chalice for Lachlan, but he wants to be able to prove that he can make decisions and run the companies without his father sitting there. So I think that he's going to have a chance to see how he goes without dad sitting next to him.
Do you think, though, if Rupert Murdoch really is in good health, as he claims and the company claims, do you think he's going to be able to really disentangle himself from this empire he's been involved with for most of his life?
When his father died in 1952, he became the chief executive of a public company. And for 70 years, he's either been the chief executive or also the chair. Now, in November, he is going to resign from the board of both companies. So he's not just going to be a non-executive director or the non-executive chairman. He is resigning from the board entirely. So this is a massive change. And I think it'll be challenging for Rupert to actually do that. And I think the reason he's probably done this is, one, to give Lachlan a chance to show how he can go, but two, at 92, he's struggling to perform those public-facing roles. I mean, he didn't want to get cross-examined in court over the Dominion matter, and they gave $1.2 billion to settle that, almost as if to stop this old man having to stand up and give evidence for hours and hours on this embarrassing Fox News stolen election narrative. So he would have had to front these two AGMs in November. These are public AGMs. I've spent 3 or 4 hours over 15 meetings asking him questions at AGMs. Mm. He doesn't like it.
That was Stephen Mayne. Next to a discovery that adds to the possibility of life existing beyond planet Earth, astronomers using data from NASA's James Webb Space Telescope have identified carbon dioxide on the icy surface of Jupiter's moon Europa. The lead researcher, Samantha Trumbo, who's a planetary scientist at Cornell University in the US, told Wendy Urquhart more about what her team had found.
Specifically, what we found was carbon dioxide concentrated in regions of young disrupted geology, particularly a region called Tara Regio, which was previously found from the Hubble Space Telescope to contain salty material that likely came up from Europa's internal liquid water ocean. So the fact that the CO2 is in this same region, that tells us that the CO2 and the carbon it contains probably also originated in that ocean below.
And what does that tell us about life on Europa?
Well, it doesn't tell us anything directly, but it is an important step towards understanding whether Europa's ocean might be habitable. Having CO2 in Europa's ocean gives us another data point on what that ocean chemistry might be. Understanding that chemistry is crucial to understanding Europa's potential habitability. And of course, having CO2 in the ocean means that there's carbon in the ocean, and carbon is a biologically essential element.
How much of a help was the James Webb Telescope in these findings?
This would not have been possible without the James Webb Space Telescope. We can't actually study carbon dioxide on Europa from any ground-based observatories because of the CO2 in Earth's atmosphere. So we really do have to go to space. JWST opened up the possibility for doing this research, and it provided enough spatial resolution to allow us to actually map this across Europa's surface and get a geography for the carbon dioxide.
So what's next? Are more missions planned?
Absolutely. There's a lot to look forward to. First of all, we will have additional observations of Europa's surface with JWST later this year, maybe the beginning of next year. Following on from that, we will have NASA's Europa Clipper mission, which is launching in the fall of next year, going to explore Europa up close. And then there's the JUICE mission from the European Space Agency, which is going to the Jupiter system as well.
We seem to be hearing a lot more about life on other planets. But what is the difference between life on Europa and life on other planets?
What's particularly exciting about the possibility of life on Europa is that it's so close to home. We're pretty sure that it has liquid water beneath its surface, more liquid water than all of Earth's oceans combined. And so if we could understand whether that environment might support life, then we have somewhere in our own solar system where we might be able to answer, I think, one of humanity's biggest questions.
Samantha Trumbo. Staying with space, and a NASA mission is due to land in the Utah desert this weekend with samples from an asteroid which scientists have warned could one day hit Earth. OSIRIS-REx gathered rocks and dust from the Bennu asteroid's surface in 2020. Researchers hope the material can provide vital clues to explain the origins of our solar system. Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, is waiting with the NASA team.
The OSIRIS-REx capsule will come screaming into Earth's atmosphere on Sunday at more than 15 times the speed of a rifle bullet. It'll make a fireball in the sky as it does so, but a heat shield and parachutes should slow the descent and bring it into a gentle touchdown on Department of Defense land. The capsule carries a precious cargo, 250 grams of rocky debris grabbed from asteroid Bennu, a mountain-sized space rock that's thought to retain the chemistry that existed when the planets formed 4.5 billion years ago. Scientists will handle the sample in sterile conditions because it might also contain the type of carbon molecules that help seed life. The theory is these could have been delivered to the early Earth by asteroids crashing onto its surface. Dante Loretta is the OSIRIS-REx mission's lead scientist.
We're addressing profound questions that at some point in our lives, everybody asks ourselves. Where did we come from? And more importantly, are we alone in the universe? By understanding how the origin of life occurred, we're taking our genealogy all the way back to the original organism that we're all related to.
It will take a couple of weeks to open the capsule under clean conditions, with scientists delivering a first take on what's inside in mid-October.
Jonathan Amos. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, here's Jackie with news of the next edition of the Happy Pod.
Yes, in this edition, the extraordinary growth of women's football in Saudi Arabia. An enormous undertaking to rewild 2,000 white southern rhino in Africa. Remember that American caver who had to be rescued from deep underground in Turkey after a medical emergency? Well, he's out of hospital now and we've been talking to him. We'll hear from the creative hotspot for Asian art that is Berlin, and the fierce yet oddly relaxed competition to be crowned Montenegro's laziest citizen. All in the Happy Pod, available from Saturday, the 23rd of September.
And we'll be back with a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Inflation, rising interest rates, volatility. Whatever markets have in store, a financial advisor can help. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.